I'm an ed specialist. My area is secondary transition.
I'm Danielle Sheldrake. I'm the administrator for student services for the Beaverton School District.
I'm Brian Agaski. I'm a special ed teacher at South Eugene High School.
I'm Sarah Mendez. I'm the registrar at South Southern High School.
And I'm Mike Maley. I'm the statewide employment first coordinator, and I'm representing the Department of Human Services.
And our visitors in the back.
Hi, I'm Tess Melio. I work for CFM Strategic Communications.
I'm Natalie, and I'm here to testify on the standardized testing graduation.
I'm Julie Brandis, probably the mom of Natalie Brandis.
And my name is John Brandis. I'm here to support my daughter, Natalie.
Thanks, everyone, for coming today, and we can move on with the presentation.
So the first thing in our district, and I'm assuming this is statewide, it may not be, when we look at diploma types, we're really looking at a regular ed issue. We're not talking specifically about special ed. So a lot of times in our district, the discussion will get pushed onto a special education teacher, which is not how, at least in our districts, it's intended. So I'm sharing some of our process. It might not be how other districts work with this, but just to give everyone an idea. So when we're looking at programs, we kind of have two different programs, and we target our education a little differently depending on the program. So we have students that will choose different types of diploma types that are mostly regular education classes. So a lot of times when we're looking at parent nights, those would look different. We also have students that are mostly in a structured learning center or life skills program. And so when I'm going to educate parents, we're looking at kind of two different populations there. For our education, we have two different types of parent nights. We have orientation programs that we run, and we talk about the different diploma types during those. So freshman orientation, we're starting to talk about this now. We're a seventh and eighth grade middle school, so we're starting to talk about this in seventh grade also when we have our parent nights. We're also having parent nights for students that are already identified in structured learning centers in the elementary school level. So on Tuesday next week, we're having an orientation for those families to come in so we can talk specifically about the diploma types and answer their questions. So we kind of do it differently for that. Then we have an official meeting. In my district, I'm the person that goes to every diploma type meeting. I'm the only counselor in our area, in the West area, that's 7th through 12th grade. And so I go to all of those meetings and discuss with families about the different types, the requirements, and what it means if a student and family chooses to have a specific type of diploma. And then we have an additional meeting that senior year, that graduation year, to make sure that that's still what the families are wanting to go towards. So in our district, there's so many different worksheets that families can use, and there's a handout on your table. This is the diploma worksheet that I work with families, because most of the information that I've found has been too cumbersome when I'm sitting down with families to look specifically at comparing the different types of diplomas. This is just a draft worksheet. It's not meant as a formal document. It's meant just as talking points when I'm meeting with families. And so right now, we look at the standard, modified, extended, and alternative certificate. We go through each of the criteria and what's required. Best practices versus reality, that's because of our shortage in funding. I'm going to probably say that a lot. We do not do things how I think that they should be done all the time. As far as who's present at these meetings, because of the amount of meetings that they have, most of the time it's the counselor working with the family, and if the student is in special education, their case manager is there also. But oftentimes when we're at these meetings, the entire teaching staff is not able to be present because most of the meetings happen during the school day. And so it would be something that I would love to see happen is for more teachers to be able to be present and really talk about their curriculum specifically and the modifications that happen. And a lot of times we're having to have separate conversations with teachers about how that happens because we can't have that meeting together. We look at this is at the meeting when we're talking about it, we look at schedule changes. What will that look like for a student if they choose a different type of diploma? what courses need to be modified. There are many students that don't need very many actual modified courses that are choosing modified diplomas, and a lot of that has to do with the amount of courses in each area that are required, or perhaps it's just one specific area, math or a writing, that is really driving this. And so we have to look at what's best for the student as far as post-high school plans and what they hope to accomplish after. So it can be a pretty long meeting when we're looking at what is in the best interest of the student. We also have to talk about, you know, for modified, at what point do modifications really change the course to being modified? And without the teachers present, that is particularly challenging with the standards that we're now looking at and the different types of grading systems that we're looking at. It's becoming increasingly more challenging to look at that as well. I also want to say for students, there's a lot of reasons that students choose other types of diplomas. Walking in graduation with their class is a huge piece. And I think that if that was a change, we may have other types of decisions being made. But it feels like a punishment so often to a student who maybe could have a fifth year and chooses not to because of the stigma it will, you know, have on them in their class. And so that's a big one for students. And then also we have a lot of students that are ready to move on in every way except for one area. And there are ways that we could help them, and we're not able to because of the policies that are currently in place. So challenges in the whole thing. Lack of counselors in school is a huge issue. And I know that because class size is such an issue right now in the state, that I think administrators are really pushing to have more of the funding into the classroom. What's happening is that all of the support staff is still being cut. So counseling staff, secretarial positions, positions at the district level, all of those are still cut to the point where it's hard to do the job well. So who does the work if we don't have, you know, an appropriate caseload of counselors? And who is training people to know how to help students the best? You know, I've said a couple times, I think, that I'm the only counselor, so my caseload's 800, and it's hard to find the time to individually work with each student to the best of the ability. Sorry, this is obviously an important subject to me. We've said that the meetings are time-consuming. Teachers are still really uneducated about the differences between modifications and accommodations. And I was at a meeting last week where a teacher said something to the effect of, if I knew my student couldn't dunk a basketball, I would never continue to ask them to dunk a basketball. Our school tends to use sports analogies quite a bit, and I'm not an athlete, so it's always hard for me to keep up. But but I just said, well, what happens if you lower the hoop? You know, what happens? And teachers still don't understand the process. I think because of some of the things that have come down from the state to the schools, some of the art of teaching has been lost. And so how can you expect standards, and how can you tell how to change those standards if you're feeling a lot of pressure to maintain those standards? That's difficult for teachers. So there's not enough education. I don't know that there's a lot of education in teaching programs about the difference between modifications and accommodations. But definitely in our school, this is a huge issue right now for us. Where it's on our in-service agenda for February is how do you help teachers that are already so overwhelmed know that this is relevant to them, and how can you have them really understand it? So that's a big challenge for us. Information dissemination is also hard in the district level. When you have laws that are passed, it's about a year process before it gets down on the ground. I'm not going to lie about that. I came to this last meeting, and I'm an expert in my district about diploma requirements, and I haven't had a chance to read about all the new laws, and the extended diploma changes have not come down to our level yet. So when I went back and then made the awkward phone call to the district saying, I have students that are on alternative certificates right now that could qualify now for an extended diploma, it's going to take a while for that to change. Because like I said, lack of funding, it takes time to look at policies. And when the school board makes policies and then they come down to our level, it's a year process. Most of that stuff happens during the summer. So there could be kids in our school, and I'm trying to make this change now that I know, but that our board won't be able to vote on that policy until summer, that will not have the opportunity to earn an extended diploma because of information dissemination. And things are changing so quickly every year that by the time we're trying to deal with the all the grading changes and not even having a chance to practice those, now we're having to change something else that's coming out. So we're feeling like we can never be experts in our field, it doesn't feel good. We have high special education caseloads. 11% is what we're funded, something like that. In my school, I'm at almost 20. And, so how do you best serve those students and families? It's a challenge. And I think I've said this, with the constant changes in education, it is incredibly challenging for teachers to keep up, to know what's current and also what's best for their students. Highly qualified is another challenge for us, and I don't know that most schools are doing this, I'm hoping, but highly qualified is still required in the subject areas. So, you can't just have a student work on language arts in a structured learning center and have that count towards English. And yet that's what so many people, parents and family, people think that they can. But if that teacher is not highly qualified in language arts, which typically doesn't happen the way that the licensing happens, they cannot award that credit. So in our area, we have a teacher who's highly qualified in PE. Her students can get PE credit. That's one credit out of the six on the extended or in all of the modified that they can award credit for. And yet we know that those students are getting excellent education in their skill level, that we are working with them in the best area possible, but we can't award that credit. And so we have more students working towards alternative certificates because of that. They're not ready to be in a classroom of 35 freshmen working on standard health. But we can give them the health curriculum. We just can't give them that credit right now. So we're trying to figure out creative ways to do that, but creative ways take time. And we don't have that. There's also a huge difference when students move from elementary to that middle high. When you have a self-contained classroom, a teacher knows that student and is with them all day long and can provide a lot of modifications that are different than when a student moves to a middle or high school level where they're changing classes every seven times or in a block schedule four times. It's different. And
can I ask a clarifying question? When you said self-contained classroom, were you referring to a third-grade class or a fourth, as opposed to a self-contained special ed class?
Okay. No, so we have a lot of elementary students that are in sixth-grade Miss Osterlin's class, and they're loving the class. They're in with their classmates, and then they come to the middle or the high school, and the parents are shocked to learn that their student is not going to be going to every seven periods because until sixth grade, everything has looked the same. Well, guess what? We don't have counselors in elementary school, and we don't have people that know the high school requirements or the middle school requirements, and so those parents are not being educated most of the time at a young level. What can we do to educate the young students? And there's policies, you have to inform consent by fifth grade or whatever. Well, you can have that by having a policy book that you hand to every parent at registration. But that doesn't mean they understand what they're reading. We need counselors in the elementary school that are meeting with all of those families who are working already at that time on what is the transition program going to look like? What is it going to look like? Right now we don't have that, at least in our district. It could be different. And also, where is the student going to most benefit? Is the student going to benefit going switching classes every period versus having some modification in a classroom where they're getting skills in their level. At what point, you know, we can have a student go seven periods and walk through classes, but what are they learning? Sometimes they're learning amazing things, but other times we need to pull them. But then does that impact their graduation status? And it does. So.
Are you talking at the middle school level specifically? Seventh and eighth or sixth, seventh, and eighth?
Well, in our district, we're a 7
through 12.
Eight. We're 7, 12 middle high. So our sixth grade is at the elementary school. I imagine for districts that have sixth grade traditional middle school, it really probably starts then, that transition from fifth to sixth grade. When I mean, it's a huge change. It's a huge change. And we don't have the time to have those students come in and meet the teachers generally beforehand, to do a lot of transition activities that we know are best practices, but we don't have the enough staff to run it. And we're doing amazing things in our district. Amazing. I'm so proud of our department. I would love for people to come look at our, we call it Excel, our living skills, our life skills program. Those students have jobs every day. They make lunch once a week for staff. I mean, they are doing so many real-world experiences. So we're providing amazing things for students. But there's so many different things that get in the way of having a best program. So in our school, counselors monitor the progress. And it doesn't matter what kind of diploma the student has. We're still monitoring whatever the graduation requirements are, whatever the post-high school plans are. I'm monitoring them as best as I can and meeting with families and meeting with students. One of the email requests was to see different transcripts. So on your table, I provided a couple of transcripts, and I know Mr. Boring from Corvallis also did, and Sarah will also be talking about this. These are just examples from our school. So it's on the page that has the diploma options, which is different than I think some of them. So for me, number one, just so you can kind of see, this is a student who is pretty much taking regular classes most of the day. They're in school. This particular student has a reading or writing disability, and finds it really difficult to perform in English at about a third or fourth grade level right now. And so for us, this student is attending classes with peers, but the English classes starting in 10th grade started to be modified. So in our district, we have a star by it. Other districts have an M. Right now, every district is looking at that differently. But this particular student is getting modification both in English and then courses. The types of courses that he's taking are different. He's not taking a full set of standard diploma. On the back page, the next page, number two, this is a student who's in our functional academic and life skills program. And the student comes out for different classes. This student's on a six-year program. They are going to still work towards a modified diploma, but this student will not be able to walk in graduation with us with their classmates because it's going to take 6 years for the student to earn the modified courses with highly qualified teachers. So that example. The example number three is a student working on an extended diploma. This student came to us from outside of our district. Was receiving some modifications. It doesn't look like that on the transcript, but again, the phone call to the other counselor, to the other school, to find out. That's what the student's working on. And then the last one, number four, is a student working on an alternative certificate. So this student is working in our Structured Learning Center all day. They have different jobs. They're learning whatever is on their IEP. That's what they're doing. So those are just some examples from our district in what transcripts look like. I don't know how much time you want to spend on accommodations and modifications. One of the questions that you asked is what's the difference? I can go into that or not. But these, when we're looking at accommodations and modifications, these are the types of questions I'm asking to the teachers and the families.
Do we have copies of this, or can we get...
It's all online.
It's okay. Thank you.
These presentations, right, Victoria?
Yes.
Yes, it's all online. If you go into OLIS, and we'll walk you through that at the end.
Yeah, okay.
And the recording can be accessed later too, right? It's also all being recorded, so you can share the recording of the hearings as well.
So these are the areas. Yeah. Go ahead.
One question I do have is on this initial transcript here that you indicated that there's modified diploma within language. Who's providing the SDI? Where are they being pulled out to be provided as specialized design instruction?
They, in their SSC electives, that is our student service center, they are receiving their specialized design instruction, and then they're in a regular English class, but they're getting modified work in that English class. And so what we've had to do for the sanity of our teachers and the records registrar who has to input all the data, we had to have the class look somewhat different so that in our grading system they had a separate tab. So when the teacher has period one English, they also have a second period one English that has the star by it. But the student does have the student service center where they receive their specially designed instruction. So we're looking at changes in timing or schedules. For accommodations, does the student need extended time? Do they need to divide the test into several sections? For changes in setting and environment, do we need to change where the student sits? Is there support, do we need to have some of the instruction taught in a different area? So those are some of the things we look at there. Trying to be brief.
Those would be accommodations?
These are all accommodations to start with. Changes in how the curriculum and our assessment is being presented. So do we need to read the directions to the student? Do we need to translate into writing? So some of the times our teachers have presentations that they provide for students, but they're orally giving the presentation at the same time. Alternative textbooks, sometimes books on tape, the outline study guides, those would be examples of accommodations. Changes in how the student responds. We have a lot of students that can stand up and speak amazing, but if you ask them to write down what they're thinking, it is not fair to that student to assume that they don't know what they're talking about when they can speak so well. And so maybe you need to provide an oral assessment. That takes a lot of time for a teacher. It does. And our teachers love to provide that. But again, when the class sizes are huge, it makes it so hard for that student to have what they need. So we've included intervention time now. We have a Wednesday intervention in our school where our students that don't need it get to be released early so that those teachers have time specifically to work with students that need it. Technology devices sometimes are used there. References and tools could be... spell checkers or graphic organizers, that kind of thing. And then the behavioral strategies. Sometimes there's contracts that are made between a teacher or counselor and a student. The progress reports, we often do things like that. When you move into modifications, we kind of look at most of the same areas, but we're looking at changing, lowering, or reducing the learning expectations. What does that look like? Are you taking the normal basketball hoop and lowering it so the student can dunk? I mean, what are you doing in your classroom to change or lower or reduce? So it could be, what are some good examples of this? Rewording or simplifying words, wording of tests. It could be that the standards are reduced. When you look at that, though, you have high school teachers that are experts in high school social studies, and you're asking them to now be experts in high school social studies and fifth grade social studies. Again, a lot of time then put in, and our teachers are doing it, but it is just a lot of time that I think is not recognized by people that are not in education. Student retells the passage in their own words, and they don't have to respond to in other ways. expectations, the standard lowers. So a lot of it has to do with lowering standards, changing the amount of requirements. So that is all I have unless there's questions.
Are there questions before we move on to Sarah? Danielle?
Well, I just, the HQ issue, so I'm just
bringing, HQ, highly qualified?
Highly qualified issue, and I'm only bringing it up because it kind of fits with this, but there was new information that districts received in September around highly qualified requirements for special education teachers at the secondary level, which is having a huge impact on diploma options. So previously, special ed teachers could award core credit, modified diploma, or extended diploma credit if they could demonstrate multiple subject competencies. So taking the Orella test, they could show that they could, you know, teach K-8, they had those skills. And that would qualify as being able to award core credit. Recently, we were notified that that is no longer sufficient and that our high school special ed teachers, in order to award modified or extended diploma core credit, will have to get single subject competency. So you may have a student who is excelling in a specialized class with smaller, with a great teacher, doing really well, making progress towards their IEP goals, who to place that student in a large 40, you know, you think are lower level courses at the high school, like your Algebra 1 or your English 9 are usually your largest classes, that the only option is to then place the student in that classroom in order to give them core credit. And in some districts, the discussion is we're moving them just to an alternative certificate because there's no feasible way that a special ed teacher can get licensed in science, social studies, math, and English. Mm-hmm. And then it's not the best option for the student. There's an IEP team who makes a decision about placement, and so now we're being forced to have a conversation about placement versus diploma and credit awarding for kids. And there's huge financial implications if you go to a model of doing team teaching, which can be great as well. But it is going to be a new layer that I believe we will see with the diploma options, and it's pretty concerning.
And where is that clarification from? Because highly qualified is a federal requirement. Is that a clarification from U.S. Department of Ed or Oregon Department of Ed?
It's a new interpretation from the Oregon Department of Education.
And there is some specific. And just a really clear example of that is, let's say that you are a middle school or a special education teacher. But even if you have an initial certificate in elementary education and you become a high school special education teacher and you have your credentials as a special education teacher to teach the modified kids and provide them credit in language arts, you would have to go past the secondary language arts assessment, which no longer is just grade 9, it's grade 9 through 12. And here's the downside to that is really making sure that your special education teachers have the expertise and the knowledge base to be able to provide that instruction to those students. So that's a real positive. And if you have teachers that have that ability to pass those tests, it's a huge benefit to kids. Now, the second fold to that is really with modified kiddos, if they're in a regular education math class with 40 kids, I think the bigger piece is really looking at saying, how do we instruct and how do we teach the regular education teachers to truly modify that curriculum where that kid can be exposed to the basic facts in that class where we don't have to really change it, and then we provide the SDI upon that support. And we've seen that model really work well with kids instead of just saying, listen, yeah, it is 40 kids, and all research indicates that class size doesn't have as much of an impact on kids as the instruction piece itself. So if we can make sure we have special education teachers along with regular education teachers, and regular ed teachers really understanding what modified curriculum looks like and how it really is individualized, then you can have some success in that and not just solely jump to, because we've seen both sides of it.
And I think in our district, we've been able to be successful for many kids who are on a modified diploma track who are accessing the general education setting. However, there is a population of students who that is not successful for them. And so what you have to look at, and it's not that we don't want that to be there, but we have a continuum of services for a reason. And now what's happening is because of licensing interpretations,
it is closing, potentially closing more doors for students, which is frightening to think about. And I know the leaders in my district are not going to allow that to happen, but there are huge financial implications about how do you set up a model for co-teaching that works, which the research suggests is a better model. However, you have to have the staffing to be able to do that. And if your district doesn't want to increase their maintenance of effort, it's really hard to handle that situation. And so it's a new factor and a new layer that goes into effect. The ODE typically makes it happen. It would be in effect like right after, you'd have to have it done by February. They're giving districts a grace period until the summer because it was a new interpretation and there was no way it could be implemented. But it's going to have a huge impact for many of our modified diploma and extended diploma kids.
So it sounds like this is an issue that's important, relevant, and timely. Should we add this to a future agenda? So, would that be helpful? Yes. And Jan, could the department help us with that as well in terms of bringing someone in? And would you be willing to be a contact to help develop that agenda? Great. All right. Other questions before Sarah launches into hers? And Sarah's materials are all on the OLIS page online on our committee website.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about communication. So a lot of times what happens is students come in and I'm like the first person that they meet for enrollment purposes. And we have a huge, huge number of transitional students in our building and particularly in our district. I want to say that most of my new enrollments, I would say about 30%, are students who are coming from outside of the district or outside of our state. So when they come to us, it kind of falls to me to ask a lot of questions and do a lot of fact-finding. A lot of times they're not very forthcoming about, oh, I'm on the IEP, oh, I'm on an alternative diploma track. We have to really dig to get information. And so what I do is I ask them, you know, one of our intake questions is, are you on IEP? Okay, yes. What's your placement? Is it a behavioral issue? Is it some other learning disability? So sometimes I can get more information that way. Most of the time, it's, I don't know. Okay, are you on alternative diploma track? No idea. And a lot of them are coming to us as, you know, sophomores, juniors, seniors. So we're looking at credits and, you know, concern, are they credit deficient? Are they on track to graduate? And often, I'm communicating to the counselors, well, unless I hear otherwise, they're on a regular diploma. So counselors schedule them in regular classes, sends them on their way, and next thing you know, the file comes, and oh, they are in a self-contained classroom on an extended diploma, or they're on a modified diploma. So then we have to kind of go back and figure out, well, how are we going to communicate that to the teachers? How are we going to get that information out to the students, to the families? Are we all on the same page? So a lot of that kind of falls to me. And so what our group asked was to get some data. So I provided some data specifically from my district. And out of the 6 comprehensive high schools, we have a little over 9,000 students who are currently enrolled. And of those 9,000 students across the 6 high schools, we have 1,376 on IEPs. And then you can kind of see the breakdown. You know, we have almost 200 on modified diploma, 78 on certificate of attainment, and 44 on extended diploma. The 12% that's listed there in the red is IEP students who are going for a regular diploma. So most of them are going for a regular diploma. However, we've seen a big jump in the last couple of years and putting more and more students on modified diploma. So that's some data just from our district. So I wanted to talk first about what I do when students come from outside of the district and how I would identify if a student is on a modified diploma if someone didn't tell me. And like I said, most of our students either don't know or they just don't tell us. So when they come in, I take a look at the different transcripts, and the only thing that really would alert me would be if a class was called basic, modified, or general. When I see that on a transcript, the first thing I do is I pick up the phone and I call that district and I say, what does this mean? Was this student on an IEP? Were they on a modified diploma? And sometimes they say, oh, well, yes, they were, or they say, they were on an IEP, not sure if it's modified. So the information I'm getting is often really inconsistent. So I don't necessarily know when a student comes to me if the classes really are modified. And we have a large population of students, particularly in our district, who are coming from alternative facilities or treatment facilities and alternative schools. And they are not necessarily identifying their curriculum as being modified. There's a lot of vague language that happens in the transcript. There's not a lot of consistency, and like I said, we don't always know. When we do know, if a student tells us or their family tells us, yes, our student's on a modified diploma, then you know we would assume we see basic credit on there. We're assuming that class has obviously been modified. But if we don't, the only thing that would alert us would be the language.
And Representative Springer has a question.
Huh?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, because we can only deal with Oregon students.
Right, right.
Proactively.
Right.
And you said many of your students are coming from out of state,
right,
and some from Oregon. What is that proportion? Because what I'm hearing, and I want to frame my question so,
right,
so it's clear what I'm looking for here, what I'm hearing is other, some, not all,
right,
some other Oregon schools are struggling with the language to give to you that you are clearly asking for.
Right. I mean, it's also an issue that's coming from our district, and I'll talk about that later. I mean, we don't have a great way to communicate when one of our students is on a modified diploma or on a, you know, extended diploma. We don't have a lot of clear language either. We did, up until recently, and our school is actually piloting, and I'll talk about that later, piloting a program where we actually finally have the ability to print a modified transcript. For the last 5 years that I've been in my position, we've only been able to print a standard, a general transcript that goes out to other districts, and we just have to hand write on there that, oh, by the way, they're on a modified diploma, and the credits aren't necessarily, when you look at our transcript, they're not necessarily coming out of the areas that they should be on a modified diploma. So we have to tell, we have to either do a hand, like a worksheet, and say, this is what it would look like. There's no, like I said, no consistency from our district, from other districts. If a transcript lands, like this one in particular landed from a alternative school, and it's kind of, I know it's kind of hard to read, but there's absolutely nothing on there that says that they were on a modified diploma. There's no, nothing to indicate that they had a curriculum modified. And so the student happened to tell us that he was on an IEP and on a modified diploma. So I called up there and they said, oh yeah, we knew he was on a modified diploma, but we didn't have a way to indicate that. So that's kind of the problem that we're encountering. It's just we're not getting the information clearly communicated to us and vice versa. Does that answer your question?
That's one of the most useful pieces right there,
right,
that I've heard. That's very useful.
Right.
Thank you.
So this is just an example. Like I said, the student came from an alternative school. There was no indication from his previous school. He'd been at a number of different schools, came to us this year as a senior, and he actually went to his case manager and asked if he could go for a standard diploma. And so our counselor and our curriculum principal asked me, has any of the curriculum been modified? And I said, well, I don't think so. You know, I called up there and they said, oh, well, yeah, he was on a modified diploma, but I'm not sure what classes were modified. I guess he could go for a standard diploma. So our team talked about it, talked with the student. He did elect to go for a standard diploma because, like I said, we don't know what's been modified and what hasn't. And so he is attempting a standard diploma. It will probably take him another year to complete, but he's okay with that. And this is what it looked like once that first transcript there was the transcript from that previous school. And then what I do is then I take it and I post it to our system. The transcript on the left side is what it was looking like what it would look like as a standard diploma. Like if he was going for a standard diploma, it's pulling all the material from the different credit amounts from the correct areas, and he would still need about 10 credits to graduate. The one on the right is actually a modified transcript, and it has a credit breakdown is correct for modified diploma graduation requirements. And there it specifically says modified diploma right there under the credit requirements, so that if he were to go to another school, the school would know that this is a modified transcript and he's going for, you know, a modified diploma. It would be very clear. And this is a student who came from a traditional Oregon high school, regular high school. We, again, did not know that the student was on an IEP or a modified diploma at the time of enrollment. The only thing that alerted us was that particular school district had mod in front of all the classes that were modified. So, you know, that we called up there, we asked them, they said, yes, those classes were specifically modified. So we went ahead and posted them as modified, but that was, again, the only way that we knew was that there was some sort of a language that would alert us on the transcript. It wasn't that we knew. And then, again, here's kind of what it looked like when we posted. When, like I said, before we started piloting our new program for our district, we did not have a way to print a transcript that showed the correct number of credits. So that was kind of an issue when the counselors would sit down with the parents and sit down with the IEP team and the student and say, okay, here's your transcript, but it's not really right. You know, you only need three math or three English classes. It says four, but you really only need three. So the parents and the students were getting really, really confused. Like, well, when I'm looking at it, this says one thing, but you're telling me something totally different. Which one's right? How do we know? So that was a big, big, big problem for our students and our counselors to try and communicate that to the families.
Next question.
So in those two transcripts,
uh-huh.
which I'm having trouble reading, and I'm close.
That's okay. I know.
So I'm assuming that those first two and a half columns look exactly the same on both transcripts.
Yes.
What looks different is the sum up.
The summary.
The left hand right. sum up is based on the standard.
And then the modified, okay, the great. Modified breakdown. Right.
Was there ever a discussion or indication looking on the IEP where it determines regular ed or modified?
When they come to our school, I don't necessarily have that information when they come to enroll. What happens is they take the IEP team does the initial intake meeting, and the IEP team will come to me and say, "Hey, we got the IEP from the other district. They were on a modified diploma," and so then they let me know. Sometimes that happens right away. Sometimes that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
For a while. So until I hear otherwise, my information that I'm conveying to the staff, to the parents, to the counselors,
yeah.
they're regular ed.
Yeah.
So it's we want to try and get that information as soon as we can.
Are the transcripts built from a kind of a pre-made software system? I know Matt was talking about the idea of why wouldn't a transcript have the two summaries. If the idea is a student is
right.
working to graduate and we'd like them to bump over to a regular diploma if they can, why wouldn't the transcript consistently show this is where you are relative to the requirements of a modified or extended, depending on where you are, and this is where you are relative to the regular? Is that a software issue?
It's a software issue. A lot of it's a software issue. I don't know how many other districts use SASE in our state. I know we do, and we're getting ready to switch to another system. Hopefully, it'll have the ability to do something like that. Right now, if a student were to leave our district and go to Newport, I would send them, and they were on a modified. I would send them, here's a standard transcript. Here's what it would look like if they were modified.
And that's not an issue at all in our district. Our SIS program, it's very easy for me to identify. It won't give me multiple, summaries, but I just say, I want you to print this out as a standard. Let me print this out as a modified, so then I can print two specific transcripts to show the family. So, I mean, ours does not have the same issue, but you have to set it up right. Whoever is setting up that summary page, doing the programming in the back, has to understand diploma tracks.
Right.
And if they don't understand, I do it at my school because my registrar does not have the information like Sarah does. She doesn't know. And so that's not really a counseling duty, but I want to make sure that when I print them for my families that they're accurate.
And so the issue on the different sum up, because I was having a hard time understanding this until
right.
Matt walked me through it like five times
right.
earlier
right.
this week. So the summary, even though the student has taken all the same classes, because that modified English class or that modified math class counts to the total required number of credits in the modified diploma, when a student is getting a transcript that shows that modified piece and they switch to a regular diploma, it's a shock for them to suddenly see zeros in what progress am I making in terms of credits next to subject areas in which they thought they were done. So the gap to get to that regular diploma is bigger than what the students understand because of the limitation of the information that's...
Correct. That's correct, yes.
Right.
So, I would add, like, 5 years ago, 4J was at that point where if you went onto a modified track, the tallying of your credits just kind of went to zeros, and it was like you had to handwrite it and go through it. And finally, we pushed for the computer programmers to go in. At that point, we were using the ESIS program, and they went in and started stacking, like, okay, you need, if you're on a modified diploma track, you need these credits in these areas. So we started to get a little bit more accurate there, where you could print out a black and white copy and be like, you have these credits and you need these remaining. And it is all programming. Now we switched programs, so now we have Our transcript has been in three different phases this year because the computer programs are trying to work with Synergy and get it so we have a transcript that's readable to other people. It's just funky is the only way to say it. So the computer programmers are constantly fixing how it's printed, and then my access or our access is all changed. It's all computer program driven to each district and what they're using. And then to try and get the information to go down to the students, the parents, with where you're at, what's going on, and what's happening.
Question. On your modified transcript, are you then... So are you indicating the courses that were in fact modified?
Yes. Yep. So that's what we've been working on this year. And I'll kind of skip through some of this here to get to that point.
Well, that's an issue.
Because we don't, that's...
So one of the issues we're having, and I don't know if you guys have experienced this in Salem, but it's the same thing when a kid comes in. Even if it says modified diploma track, the hard part is if it's not indicated it's a modified course... Because not all kids are taking every class modified, it's hard to then say, okay, yes, this was modified. So if you had a kid who decided they wanted to transition to a standard diploma track, if you took it to say, oh, you were on a modified track, that means every course was modified, now you're back to zero and you have to take all of those classes. So the disconnect, one of the things we're working on is that the special ed teachers are accurately reflecting which courses they're going to take modified, and then it's getting on the transcript to say, okay, they took a modified English class, but they didn't take modified PE.
Right.
And then so that if they decided to go to the standard track, they're not having to redo classes. But that step, I think, across the board has been missed because they're just like, well, they're taking the class, you know, they're on a modified track. And so we're trying to...
So
that becomes an issue.
What we're doing is, and I kind of skipped forward here in our presentation, is our district, and particularly my high school, we are working with our technology and our software developers to identify which courses were actually taken for modified credit. So what we've done is anything that has a dash M on our transcript is being taken for modified credit. The only, and then having the ability to print a modified transcript. That's something that's only been recently, and is only for our specific school at this point, until we get the okay from our district to move forward and do it with all the other high schools. The only problems that we're running into is not every other district will necessarily know that a dash M means that they were taking it for modified credit. The person who's printing the transcript, so that would be me or a counselor, they would have to know that a student is on a modified diploma to print the modified transcript. So there's that kind of disconnect. Like, how do you know? And you know, our counselors have 500 kids on their caseload, so they don't always know which student's on a modified diploma. Often it falls to me to communicate to them and say, these are the students that I have that are on a modified diploma. And they can print a transcript that way. Our district also doesn't currently have the ability to print OAKS scores on our transcript. So we have to send those separately. And we don't necessarily have a way to indicate, you know, a modified diploma student cut scores, special accommodations yet, you know, at least for our district. We can't do that yet. The dash M on the transcript doesn't necessarily mean the student's on a modified diploma. It only means that the curriculum was modified. So if we have a student who's on an extended diploma, it'll say dash M because the curriculum was modified. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were on modified diploma. So there's some kind of there's still some vagueness and some stuff that we got to work through in order to make it kind of perfect. So this is an example from our district of what we're trying to do. And so you can see it, and it's kind of hard to see, but right here the language art class is a dash M, which that means that student it was modified for that particular student, and this student is on a modified diploma. We don't have a way to print an extended diploma transcript. We're still kind of back on that same, like, we just have to tell them and verbally tell them that, or we could put a stamp on it or write it somewhere that the student's on an extended diploma. And this is kind of an explanation of what our district is doing and how they propose to change the numbers. And this is information that our curriculum principal gave to me, and it just kind of talks about what each, like, the SO here, it indicates the subject. The next number indicates like the specific area, the order of the class, and then however long it is. So that if it's a 2, it's for a semester long. If it was a 4, it'd be for a year long. And then after, they would you'd note if it was a modified class or not. And for extended diploma, we're trying to do the same thing for extended diploma. The extended diploma, if it was specifically, it would have an EX after the course title. But a dash E means they're going for elective credit. So if you have a student who's on modified diploma and they go for like an English class or language arts class that's going as an elective class or a math class that's going for an elective class, it would be a dash E instead of a dash M. So just kind of, we're trying to make it simple, like, but at the same time, it's also kind of creating its own set of problems. In our district, it seems to be working okay, but I've had students who've gone out of our district, I get other districts calling saying, what in the world is this? What's a dash E? What's a dash M? So then it's calling to me to make sure I'm communicating correctly to the other districts. So what would be nice, what we would love to see come out of all this, would be to have some sort of universal language or something that was consistent, at least for the state of Oregon. You know, most of the students who are moving out of our district are usually going to an Oregon school. Most of the time, they're not going out of state or vice versa. Most of our students are moving within the state. It'd be nice to have some sort of universal language that way we would all know, instead of, you know, like I know that READ 180 is, it has to be called READ 180, you know, for our state or for the you know, federal government. But it'd be nice to have something that would be like that. That way we know when a student's on extended or our modified diploma.
Well, thank you so much. Those were fantastic presentations. I learned a lot. Are there some final questions before? We're a little behind on the agenda because the presentations are really good. Are there any final questions? And as a follow-up, I'm thinking we can invite the department back, Jan, to talk about what a process might be for developing that common language. That seems like something that's probably more appropriately handled through rule or the department than having the legislature try to talk about what you all write on transcripts. Seems like a pretty scary place to go. Any other questions, comments, or suggestions of other follow-ups besides the highly qualified and licensing issues that have come out of this presentation that we should add to a future agenda? Bridget.
Just a quick comment from the higher ed side. Because of these changes, it's getting even harder and harder to recruit students to come in and train to be secondary teachers because they won't be able to get jobs when they're done, and it will require them to take multiple tests. So it's not only going to hurt our districts, we're going to be really short of secondary special ed teachers here pretty shortly.
And that's the highly qualified?
The highly qualified issue, right. That we just can't. You know, right now we already have a two-year program, and that's adding multiple more years to those to get both certifications together because of the requirements. It's just fiscally and their step out, we're going to have more of a problem further on.
Very much. And I think we're going to go out of order of the agenda because we're already talking about, we just had some conversation about accommodations and modifications. So, Susan, if it's okay, can I flip the next two? So next we're going to talk about some of the barriers that students with disabilities have to getting a standard diploma, which is the goal that we have for all students is to be able to get to a standard diploma. So we're going to talk a little bit about the impact of standardized assessments and the access to accommodations and modifications to getting a regular high school diploma. So we've got Derek Brown from the Department of Ed, but first we have Natalie Rose Brandis, who's here to talk a little bit about her experience with this issue, and I think she has a way of very clearly helping us understand some of the barriers that maybe we don't need to have in the path of kids trying to get a standard diploma that have worked very hard.
Does she need to be mic'd? If you can just turn that one a little, it'll pick her up. That'd be fine.
And before Natalie speaks, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis. I'm Natalie's mom. I noticed there's a reporter in the room today, and I just wanted to maybe sensitize you to a student who is in special education. Especially in Natalie's case, she has done so in a very anonymous fashion. She's on the record today. You have her testimony. But if you think about talking about this issue, it would be really great if you could maybe protect her in terms of, you know, a student from Crescent Valley or something like that. That protects her from her peers. And we can talk about it offline, but I just wanted to make sure you were aware of that.
She will speak in a second.
She will. She'll speak in a second. Yeah.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Natalie Brandis. I'm a senior at Crescent Valley High School in Corvallis. I'm here today to speak about my personal experience in high school and especially earning a diploma in transitioning out of high school. I'm here today to ask that the task force to consider recommending that when high-stakes tests are required for graduation, such as the OAKS test, students with learning disabilities be allowed to use their same accommodations that we have always used for coursework and course assignments. If those accommodations cannot be granted, then the test should be waived for students in special education. California waives their graduation tests, and Washington has many alternatives. As a bit of background, I was diagnosed with a variety of learning and cognitive disabilities when I was in the first grade. My disabilities make almost every class very difficult for me. Right before high school, when we began assessing by CDRC at Dornbecker, they warned that high school would be difficult for me, and it has been. To be a successful student, we have hired tutors, paid for summer classes, spent many hours on homework and studying. It usually takes me 2 or 3 times more to complete an assignment than my classmates. Developing a very detailed individual education plan, utilizing a variety of modifications and accommodations.
Just a point of reference. Sorry, she said modifications. I just want to clarify that she just misspoke, and it's important that you realize she has done no modifications in her high school diploma, on her quest for high school diploma. Sorry, Nana, I didn't mean to do that.
You're doing great, Natalie.
Go ahead, yeah.
Use no modifications. Today, I'm a Model CV student. I have a 3.2 GPA. By June, I will have passed all the classes necessary to graduate. By June, I will have passed all the classes necessary to get into college. I'm active in our leadership class. I've earned 3-year letter varsity on cheerleading, and I've been accepted to Western Oregon University. While this is all good news, we are growing more and more distressed because I'm struggling with the mandatory OAKS test. If I do not pass the OAKS test, I will not be able to walk with my class and earn my high school diploma. As I'm sure you can guess, standardized testings are often very challenging for children in special education. What makes us very angry is many of our accommodations that I have utilized to be a successful student are not allowed on the OAKS test. Let me give you an example. Last spring, CV offered a class to work on a writing work sample, and you have to do 2 of those and pass both instead of doing the OAKS. Following a week of instruction with work on samples and then submitted it. I was told that I could not use any of the accommodations that I've always been able to use. As an example, I struggled with spelling. I'm not lazy. I always did well on spelling tests in grade school. But after a while, my mind takes the word and jumbles it up. And when I try to recall the word, I write it down and spell it wrong. I might get close enough, but not close enough for spell check to find the error. I use current technology. I just say the word, and the correct spelling shows up. On that test, I earned passing scores of 4 on every one of the rubrics, except for the convention rubric. Also, the OAKS test weighs conventions more heavily than other areas. This fall, I took a second OAKS writing sample. Again, I was told that I could not use accommodations. Then we were told by the school district I could use Kurzweil software. My writing teacher was so excited, and the principal was excited too. But she said we better get it in writing. Then the Department of Education told the district that was not allowed. Now I've been told I can use text-to-speech. So last week, I submitted my 3rd sample in the frustrating that my district and the Department of Education cannot answer or even the same answer in the 6-month period. What is more frustrating is that I can't use accommodations that I've always used since a freshman. These are accommodations that I can use in college, too. Western Oregon University has accepted me, and part of my acceptance includes a list of accommodations that will be granted to me. These accommodations are at the end of my comments. As for my Reading Oaks sample, I have not even been given a test this year. When I read a textbook or a novel for school, I utilize text-to-speech. It's not because I can't read. It's because I read very slowly, and I lack fluency. However, if I use text-to-speech, I have excellent comprehension. Last year in literature class, I earned A's and B's in my test relating to the novels that we read. Finally, the math sample tests are probably my weakest link. My disabilities include working memory struggles. It's pretty hard for me to pull for a formula from my brain, so yes, the math OAKS test will be a struggle. I took extra math classes, including consumer financing class, so I know how to finance a new car, but I can't pass the OAKS test. I want to remind you that if I don't pass the OAKS test, I don't get to graduate. My school district won't let me walk with my classmates unless I accept a modified diploma. I would rather wait and get my general diploma because I need it for college and for federal financial aid. In conclusion, I've been accepted to go to college and plan to continue my education when I'm in college. I will have many accommodations. I'm getting more and more worried that I'm going to get stuck without a general diploma because of the OAKS test. I may have to settle for a modified diploma and lose access to federal financial aid. If I stick it out for the general diploma, I will be embarrassed in front of my classmates at CV because I will not be able to graduate. I'm being punished for being in special education and not rewarded for exceeding everybody's expectations. Please, when you look at your high school transition policy for students in special education, consider policies that grant full accommodations for high-stakes tests to students with disabilities, or consider waiving those tests.
Natalie, thank you so much. You've done an extraordinary job, and I think if we look at the number of kids that graduate from high school that are on IEPs, in Oregon right now it's only about 42%. And you've got to think about who are those 58% of the kids that are so much like Natalie, that have done better than anybody expected because you're smart, you work hard, and you don't take no for an answer. And you're just extraordinary. And I'm so glad that you had the courage to come and talk in a public place about something that's pretty hard and really very unfair to you. Are there questions or comments for Natalie?
I have one.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that this question's for you, Natalie. I don't even know, Mom, if maybe you can address this. It's certainly a question that I'm going to find an answer to, and that is, what specifically prevents you from having those modifications on the OAKS test? Is it federal law? Is it state law? Is it school district policy? I'm hoping for a very clear answer from somebody on that, because that's where we need to look at, and if it is being interpreted appropriately.
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, what we've been told, first of all, we haven't been told consistent answers from either the district or the state. So that's a little problematic. But what we've heard is that this rests with federal policy. And I'm not sure that we can make that connection either when we've heard. And it's hard to understand the Washington, how Washington addresses their graduation assessments, and California, if they're the same thing, if they're different things. But, you know, what we're seeing is like a waiver in California for special ed. And I'm not sure, again, if it's completely and perfectly aligned. And for Washington, I would say greater, if I read the law correctly, more opportunities for probably what would be an expanded work sample. So it's more of like a portfolio for that student to verify that he or she has, you know, taken Algebra 2, and this is how she approached it, and this is how she was successful in that class, as opposed to, again, doing that sample on a given day. Today's your math sample. Sit down, take it, go for it. You know, I don't know how Oregon is interpreting it differently, and I heard somebody over here say federal as well. So
there are some ties to that with the state, and it is a little convoluted. Absolutely.
And we do have the department after this to talk about this a little bit.
Right, because convoluted is something we can and should
address so we can get a clear answer for sure. So one thing, Natalie, that I want to say to you is, and I'm not speaking out of turn, I have permission, I've had it for a long time, my son, who's a junior in high school, struggled with similar issues with fluency forever. And I get, because I've sat and watched it at my dining room table, how much effort you have had to put in to work through that and to get it done, and the work ethic that you and he share, I think, is probably pretty off the charts for teenagers and some adults, I know for sure. So, good job.
Thank you. Brian, you had one
in the queue. I run into that same issue of trying to, we have accommodations, students successful for multiple years, and then come up to the Oaks and come up to work samples and accommodations that they use, they can't get it. We've come through reading through the ODE guidelines around like administering the Oaks, and we've even had that same thing of some accommodations that we worked through last year. This year our district is interpreting those as not following what the handbook's saying, and we've lost some ground there, and it's an ongoing battle. I'm sorry you have to struggle with that every day. It shouldn't be part of it. I really feel for you.
Any other questions or comments before we excuse Natalie and Julie? Thank you very much. And thank you also, Natalie presented to the Corvallis School Board earlier this week as well. And I hope that you're successful in your request there as well. If I can help, let me know.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make one point as you talk about transitions, high school transitions, and I hope that's okay. Is that all right?
Absolutely.
We have started Natalie's tours of universities, and one of the things that I find so compelling are the disability teams on the campuses are very experienced with this. They were somewhat appalled that their lack of accommodations for these Oaks tests. You have the list that Natalie will be provided for every single test she takes at Western Oregon University. She has not been fully accepted to Oregon State yet, but I expect it will be similar. One of the things we asked about a great deal when we were preparing for the transition and meeting with these offices was, what about the SAT? Because, again, you're in the same boat. You're in that high-stakes, standardized testing. Basically what they said to us is, SATs serve some purpose. They serve some purpose when we are looking at a limited student population, especially like in honors college. If you're looking at presidential scholars, SATs serve some type of predictive value in that area. Otherwise, it doesn't serve much of a predictive value, especially in underrepresented populations. So they said, breathe easy, Natalie. You have to take it. It's an OUS rule. Go take it. And here, like I've said, she just took the SAT last week, and as she said, she's already been accepted to Western. So, I think we may be putting the value in the wrong areas and not more highly in the work ethic and what the outcomes are.
Julie.
Thank you so much again, Natalie. It was really wonderful to hear from you. I hope that you have also applied to Portland State. And as you're experiencing, we have an excellent Department of Disability Resource Center that really works closely with each of our students. And on the other end, as an instructor, I think it's just we have a great kind of seamless support system there. You're very correct in terms of the kinds of assessments that we're asking of even people getting into teacher education programs. And I've worked really hard so that we are allowing standardized tests in our departments and into grad and even doctoral programs as a part of our portfolio, but not really looking at the cut scores, and those aren't determinants. So thank you for also mentioning that topic.
And I believe Representative Springer had one final question.
Thank you, Madam
question.
Chair. I have to know, what do you want to do with your college degree when you're done? Well, so you get that question.
I'm just focused on passing the Oaks. So I haven't time to think about what I want to do outside of.
With a college degree, you'll have lots of options.
And more importantly, with your work ethic and your determination and your skill and your courage, I can't imagine there's anything that you can't do. Thank you very much. Department is next. Welcome.
Derek, thank you for coming. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Representative Gelser. Again, for your record, my name is Derek Brown. I'm the Director of Assessment at the Oregon Department of Education, and I also have some hand in overseeing graduation requirements to some extent as well. So hopefully I can help continue this dialogue around the differences really between accommodations and modifications, what that might mean on a summative state test, which is what I refer to when I say OAKS. That's an end-of-the-year summative state test. And then in the state of Oregon, our graduation policies are actually quite flexible in terms of allowing schools and districts to utilize other sources of evidence to certify that students have met the graduation requirements or essential skills proficiencies. So with all of that in mind, I prepared a short point paper to walk through. I found as Raina Mattson was going through her presentation that we will have some overlap, so I'll go through this material and it might add a bit of context, again, in terms of talking about the differences between between accommodations and modifications, and then perhaps we can address some of the other issues as well. So excuse me, I think I said for the record, I'm Derek Brown, Director of Assessment at Oregon Department of Education. Accommodations are different from modifications in some very distinctive ways. First of all, they're defined as practices and procedures in presentation, response, setting, and timing, or scheduling, that when used in an assessment, provide equitable access to students. Accommodations, and again, Raina addressed this, do not compromise the learning expectations, construct, grade level standard, and or measured outcome of the assessment. It's important to think about that a little bit more, especially in terms of that grade level content piece. The OAKS assessment, again, as an end of year summative assessment, is intended to measure student learning against grade level standards and content. So whenever we make accommodations on an assessment, they are reflective of the accommodations that are made during instruction, and they do not compromise that level of rigor and that grade level standard, so forth. Accommodations are intended to reduce or even eliminate the effects of a student's learning challenges during instruction and on the results of the assessments. Implemented appropriately, accommodations should not reduce learning expectations, nor should they give a student an unfair advantage over his or her classmates. When accommodations are applied, we refer to that assessment, whether it be the OAKS state assessment or perhaps a local work sample, we use the term standard administration. I would say that in light of some of the other comments and dialogue that's gone on at this point, that the accommodations, there's a fairly long, exhaustive, comprehensive process that takes place on an annual basis for the approved accommodations to be published. So we have a group of folks at the Oregon Department of Education. Sally works fairly closely with these folks that bring in experts internally and externally to walk through that process of what should these accommodations look like for students with disabilities, for English language learners, and so on and so forth. And they're vetted through many different steps until then at the end of that process the group builds consensus and decides, yes, this is the approved list of accommodations. So that's, I think it's important to keep in context the process that's used there. Modifications are practices or procedures used during instruction or assessment that change, lower, or reduce the learning expectation of the student when applied. And Raina addressed the major categories of modifications: test directions, how students respond, how the questions are presented, and test setting. In the case of modifications, when modifications are applied to an assessment, then it's no longer a standard administration, and we refer to that as an invalid assessment for purposes of accountability. Modifications, of course, must be considered carefully, as they may have adverse effects on achievement and reduce the opportunity for students to learn critical content. Anything outside the scope of a standard administration assessment, which is defined in a number of different documents that ODE produces on an annual basis, is considered a modification. So an easier way for me to say that is there's no single complete exhaustive list of modifications. Modifications generally talking about changing how test questions are presented and how students might respond. Other examples would include things like lowering the achievement standard or the rigor of the assessment. Reducing the choices on a multiple choice assessment would be a modification. Providing hints, clues, or coaching during the assessment. In the case of English language arts, so reading in particular, fairly common modifications that I hear about when I talk to districts would include reducing the overall word length of an excerpt, so the volume of the extract, and then also then the rigor or text complexity, which we generally talk about in terms of the Lexile level. So those are adjustments that can be made that do reduce the expectations and change the construct to the point that it's not an accommodation, but rather it's a modification. In my work at the department around the essential skills specifically, what I most often hear in terms of modifications on work samples, how that is articulated to me from districts generally is making adjustments to the CUT score. So again, modifications can take a number of different forms, and the department doesn't produce an exhaustive list and publish that. We do that work in the area of accommodations, but anything that's outside of approved accommodations and outside of approved standard administration is considered modified. But I get a lot of phone calls and emails from school districts asking about what does it look like for us to make an adjustment to the level of rigor of a work sample. So again, that could be something along the lines of for a reading work sample, for example, choosing an article that's reduced in word length or volume, or perhaps finding an extract, a magazine article, a newspaper article, or something along those lines that has a lower Lexile level, a lower grade level of Lexile. Those would all be examples of modifications. Again, I think I talked a little bit about the process for the accommodations table to be produced every year and what we go through there. We have accommodations for work samples in place as well, and we've tried to mirror the infrastructure, if you will, of OAKS accommodations, so that in the area of local performance assessment, we have some consistency there. But although there can be some places where that might vary a little bit, like, for example, test setting. When we administer OAKS assessments, we're very clear about what that test administration setting needs to look like. But in the case of a local performance assessment, like a work sample, it doesn't necessarily need to be in a computer lab, for example. Work samples can be administered in a classroom, and that's fine. That doesn't change the construct or the expectation of learning in order for us to be able to certify that the student can read and comprehend text, for example. I brought a couple of more concrete examples just to share, and then maybe I'll pause and find out what questions you might have. I have an example of a work sample question where a student's asked to, I'll just read it briefly and then I'll move on. Alex had a bag filled with colored tiles. It contained 4 red tiles, half as many green tiles as red tiles, 8 purple tiles, and then it carries on. A modified version of that would be, instead of saying half as many green tiles, but to say 2 green tiles, so to give the student that piece of information. That would be a modification. We've changed how we've presented the question, and we've adjusted the level of rigor. So if we gave the regular one and the modified one to 2 different students, we wouldn't be measuring them the same way in terms of learning, in terms of us finding out more about what they've learned, what knowledge and skills do they now possess after instruction. Another example would be providing formulas to students. So there are prompts where you can give students a series of pieces of information that you know that they need to be able to connect in a basic algebraic equation, and then ask them to work through that. You could change the presentation of that particular question by asking exactly the same question, but then giving the students the formula. They still have to plug the pieces of information into the formula to produce a response, but we have adjusted the construct. We've changed it, so we're not measuring the same way between those two examples. And then I think both Raina and I talked about on a multiple choice kind of a test, just reducing the number of options for a student, or any combination of those kinds of things would really cross over from accommodations into modifications. I wanted to maybe just do a couple of more quick points before I ask for questions. Really appreciated getting to hear your testimony. Thank you for that. I want to make sure I'm clear about a couple of pieces of elements of Oregon's graduation policies. We do not, students do not have to pass the Oaks assessment to earn a diploma. There is no guidance in state law or guidance specifically from Oregon Department of Education that says that students have to pass that test. In fact, Oregon is very different from many states in that we provide, or policy rather, provides a wider range of options. Students can pass the Oaks assessment, and over the past 2 years with the first two essential skills, the predominance of students have used Oaks to meet the reading requirement. We're getting ready to release the next essential skills report that will help us learn more about how students met the writing requirement last spring. Many students use Oaks, but work samples are a viable option, and many districts use those. It will vary from one district to the next in terms of how they administer those assessments, the policies they set up around the administration of work samples. Work samples are developed locally by school districts. They are scored locally by school districts. And so the reason that more evidence is necessary if students use work samples is that they are locally developed and locally scored, different from, say, the Oaks writing assessment, which is managed at the state level. The Oaks writing assessment, we go through very comprehensive processes a couple of times per year to train the raters, to check their accuracy, to certify them, to ensure that they are judging the students' writing ability in a valid and reliable way, consistently across everything that they see. Our policies allow for districts to use writing work samples, staying with that example, to certify that a student can write effectively. But we have to require more evidence. The stakeholder groups that came together to mull over that problem and make recommendations to the state board all agreed, we should allow a local determination of demonstration of proficiency, but we need to ask them to collect more evidence. Also with work samples, I think it's worth pointing out, students can revise work samples. That's allowable. And the way districts manage that will vary from one to the next. But a student could be given a writing work sample. They could complete it. Let's say, for example, that they scored, there are four categories that are required, four domains, if you will, within writing. And let's say that they got a four in three of those categories, which is the six-point scale. They need to have a minimum of four. But in conventions, they got a three. The teacher can give that back to the student with the scoring guide that provides the information that tells them that they hit the achievement standard in organization and sentence fluency and the other pieces, but they need to go back and through and consider conventions and do some revising. And then that can be scored again, just that trait. That, as a matter of fact, that can happen multiple times. That is allowable under the Oregon's graduation policies. Whether or not districts choose to do that, the degree to which they choose to administer it in that fashion would vary, and I would have to...
Can I ask a question about that? I think in one of the earlier presentations, there was a conversation about information dissemination and what is true and what people believe to be true, what can be done and what the practice is. Mm-hmm. What efforts is the department making to inform districts about their flexibility? For instance, when you were saying it can be done more than once, I see Julie shaking her head, not true in our district, and I believe they said because the state says you can't.
How many, when you got the chance to do your writing sample, how many chances did they give you to correct?
They gave us one chance to correct it, and that's it.
Yeah. Is that the Oaks writing assessment, or is that a local work sample?
It's on both. I mean, it's on both, so we can only get one shot.
Yeah. So that would be a local decision. Now, on the Oaks writing assessment, let me talk about that one for just a second. The Oaks writing assessment is, I think, a little unique in terms of how we might compare to other states and how they measure writing. We ask students to go through an authentic writing process. The Oaks assessment, typically, and it may or may not have been Natalie's experience, is a multi-session experience for them, where they can go in and they can spend 45 minutes outlining and thinking and maybe even starting some initial rough drafting. They can come in a second session, and they can actually create a first draft if they want to, or they can create a first draft and then begin polishing that into a final draft. They can come back a third session to continue that work. There's really no time limit on the Oaks writing assessment. It can be a multi-session opportunity, different from, say, ACT writing or SAT writing. Timed 30-minute exam that also has some multiple choice questions that go along with it. So those are different constructs, we would say. And then that all goes into the scoring process. Work samples would be, they can look and probably should, I hope, look very similar to that process. Districts can offer work samples to students, and they can allow them to take multiple sessions to complete that work. They can allow the student to go through the revision process before it even gets scored a first time. They can allow them to do it in a paper-pencil format. They can allow them to do it online on a laptop computer. There's quite a bit of flexibility there for districts. I would have to go talk to the folks at Corvallis to find out more. Districts have the authority to make district-level decisions about how they administer. It would be within a district's right from a policy standpoint to say, we are going to put a cap on revision, for example. And they could define student eligibility around utilizing work samples or revising work samples in any number of ways. It becomes really a district decision to decide what to do with that.
Oh, Senator Edwards was in the queue first, and then Raina.
Well, I just wanted to highlight that. I mean, this example and this exchange highlights a problem that's more global than just the issues we're talking about today, and that is not just communication between departments and local districts, but I mean, there are times where, you know, local districts, for whatever reason, for whatever pressures they're feeling, misrepresent state law or department rules as being, and they scapegoat them because they just don't want to do, or they try something new and it kind of gets all botched and messed up and it's not administered well, and then they say, well, we're being directed to do this by the state. I'm working on a case in Junction City right now where this is the case, and clearly, I mean, the Junction City School District or administrators there were just lying to parents about what they were being directed to do, and then only with my intervention and getting to the bottom of it, we found out, well, actually, you know, you guys tried to do something new, and it's not working out so well, and you know, this legislature did not direct you to do this, nor did the department. So, yes.
Okay.
And that can happen as well. And so, while I've had, you know, many issues with the department in the past, it's not to say though that, you know, local districts always get it right, because they don't.
Representative Gelser, could I add one? I wanted to finish answering your question. I'll
do
it very briefly. You had asked about, the essence of your question was around what are we doing to communicate to make sure there's clarity about the policies. We use a number of different tools. I think that there is always room for improvement in communication. One requirement that we have and that districts participate with us in is we train district test coordinators on an annual basis on a number of different elements about our assessment system. A lot of it's very focused on the Oaks assessment because we've got some very stringent administration and security issues associated with that. But we also require work sample training in order to ensure that every district has the clarity around the state level allowances, so to speak. So, for example, students can use work samples and they can be revised. We go through that process with districts every single year. And then on top of that, we use our other communication tools, and I certainly get out and visit with districts and ESDs quite a bit. We've built a number of training modules specific to how to score work samples that always is embedded with, on the front end, here are the state-level policies about the administration of work samples. If you're going to allow that to be evidence that students can use, the state allows it. How the district chooses to implement it can vary.
the process that you described in the writing, and it's the same with the math work samples and the reading, it's a very long process. It takes a lot of time, and what we found for a lot of our students that don't meet the OAKS the first time, that we either have to choose content in senior English. Are we going to provide the content that's required in senior English, or are we going to provide the multiple opportunities for those work samples that don't always match up with the standards that we're being told to have? So that's one challenge for our English teachers then. You know, are we going to provide that amount of time out of our classroom? Or are we going to try to find time for both the student and someone, the staff that we don't have, to provide that time? Because the students that I'm working with, that some of our special ed teachers are working with, we've had multiple special ed teachers certified through the work sample process that they can provide that time. It's sitting down and that extra effort to spend with the student to really communicate effectively. And a lot of our students are being successful with the multiple revisions. It is a great process. Our students, we don't even, for many of our students, retest in OAKS their senior year if their score is certain. We just say, okay, we're going to spend the year working on work samples, but where do you find that time or the funding to provide what the student needs? That's a challenge.
And what do you suppose is the improvement in the student's life following high school for that extra time spent on getting the work sample right as opposed to taking the course content?
Well, we choose not to destroy that course content. We keep them in and we pull them from others. But that's a philosophical discussion that each year we're having to discuss. There are some students that have benefited greatly from doing the work samples, from improving an understanding. There are others that, you know, they're going to go to college and be successful, and they're never going to take math past math 111, and they will, and yet they're being asked to do work samples that are far beyond math 111. And so for that student, is it a great use of time to do the work samples? Probably not, but it's so important that they walk and they receive that standard diploma that we're going to take that extra time to do that. But it's hard. It is a challenge in the local schools to spend that time and help those students through that process, because it's scary, it's hard, there's a lot of pressure, the anxiety that comes across now on these work samples to get them done. It's hurting our kids.
Derek, is there a federal requirement that says that if a student has an appropriate grade point average, has met and passed all of the courses necessary to graduate from high school, that they must pass an assessment? Would Oregon have the flexibility to allow all students to take an assessment? I know that we have to make them available to all students,
right.
Allow students that have done everything that they're supposed to do to move on with their lives and have a high school diploma and go on to college?
Mm-hmm. I would say that it's certainly our current set of graduation requirements are state-derived, if you will. So I believe that there is certainly flexibility for the state of Oregon to define the exit outcomes to include the regular diploma. With the regular diploma, you know, there is some connection to the federal government in terms of the requirements or the fidelity of what that piece of paper means, because we use it for graduation reports, and it is attached to other federal accountability measures. But there are others at the department that might be able to articulate a better response. But, you know, the other exit outcomes that we currently have in place are really state-level requirements.
And I guess the second question, do you have an estimate at the department of the increased number of kids that will not be able to graduate once the Smarter Balanced is? I mean, how many kids are going to not be able to go to college, not be able to get a job because of the Smarter Balanced?
Hmm. I don't have a firm number for you on that, Representative Gelser. We have begun to take a look at some correlation between Smarter Balanced and OAKS using some NAEP linking. So we're really on the front end right now of starting, because we have conducted studies in the past to understand the relationship between OAKS and NAEP, and we know Smarter Balanced wants to set its standards consistent with NAEP. We can look at that. Important, I really want to make sure I'm clear about this. The charge that we have in front of us in terms of the transition from OAKS to Smarter Balanced is to determine the equivalent level of rigor. So even though we're going to go, most districts have already transitioned to new standards, and we are going to transition to a new assessment that measures those standards appropriately, we are developing the methodology to determine what is the equivalent to a 236 relative to Smarter Balanced. It's possible and likely, I would say, that that particular line in the sand, student accountability, I would say, will be different than the line in the sand that we use for federal accountability systems, or for purposes, rather. So we know that Smarter Balanced will likely establish an achievement standard consistent with NAEP, and that's probably higher than what we're currently dealing with a 236. But for student accountability purposes and the awarding of diplomas to students, that wouldn't be the mark. We need to find an equivalent to the 236. So we're doing that kind of work now. We'll be engaging everyone along the way in the process and certainly taking that kind of information to the state board for them to provide feedback.
I guess one last question just to clarify before. If the meeting whatever uniform standard we've stated on the Oaks is a state determination,
yes,
would the state of Oregon face some sort of a federal financial penalty if the legislature passed legislation that said a student that has completed all of their required high school requirements shall not be denied a high school diploma solely because they have not passed a high-stakes test?
Representative Gelser, I don't have a good answer for you on that particular question, but I'll ask Jan to maybe come back with me and engage Cindy and some of the other folks at the department to give you a response to that.
And my guess is that it wouldn't, since until a couple of years ago you didn't have to pass the high-stakes test to get the standard diploma.
Yeah, our policies specific to the essential skills, well, really more broadly than that, graduate regular diploma requirements state that if you increase the rigor, if you add requirements, or if you increase the rigor of current requirements, raise the achievement standards, then you have to give adequate notice to students and to districts, and that's defined in state law as March 1st of an eighth grade year. So that connects to when I said we have to find the equivalent level of rigor to the 236 on Smarter Balanced. We're going to go through that process and find that, and then if stakeholder groups and state board and others were to say we see a discrepancy between what that looks like and what that federal line will be, if there were a decision to raise the bar, then we would provide adequate notice. And then so we can't say to students that are in their junior or senior year this year, we're raising the bar on you, we're changing expectations. We have to give adequate time to prepare.
Are there any other questions for Derek?
I had a couple. I really liked the information from you. It's pretty nice to hear, so thanks.
Thank you.
Package it really well. I gotta just ask straight up, when you have students that are using speech to text, text to speech, audio versions of textbooks, novels, all those things are accessible accommodations that they use 100% of their time, why are they removed for the state test?
Again, on that, it's a great question, I'm not a deep expert in our accommodations manual. I deal with it a fair amount, but Sally's peers, I think, in the office that she works in that really lead the work to develop that, I'd really need to talk to them about why that might look different. Accommodations really ought to mirror the supports that are provided during instruction. And Not a perfectly clear answer to your question, but I would add that as we now transition to Smarter Balance, the work that we've begun to do is to take a look at what that set of supports looks like in comparison to what we're currently providing to help folks that are out teaching every day understand what are the differences, what used to be a support and now it's not, and that informs how I might need to change instruction to prepare students so that we do have some consistency. But I
asked that question because years ago in my classroom, my program and stuff, we just got up and went to Lane Community College, went to the University of Oregon and looked at what they did for disability resources, and it was basically, I mean, to use it, it was perpendicular to the way we were applying our accommodations in the, 9 to 12 grades, but then even trickling down. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so wrong that if we're preparing students for these different choices, that we're not aligning our our supports and services.
Right.
And the way that disability resources work and the way an IEP works, kind of, you know, they didn't go in the same direction. And we started kind of turning that around, and then the high stakes test came in and kind of, you know, took back another level mm-hmm. on like what we were providing, and then seeing like positive outcomes in students, and not just a better grade, a better GPA, but that unmeasurable piece of how somebody feels about themselves and their self-esteem. And we have data that so links the mental health issues with students with disabilities, because we look like everybody else, but we might not achieve to these arbitrary, you know, levels. And they're not arbitrary. They're set and they're mm-hmm. given to us. But
yeah.
So I don't know how we, like, move in a better direction towards that.
Yeah. I think the best thing that I could do for you in response to that is, A, say that I know that our accommodations panel that does the leads that process that I described earlier is representative of a fairly broad education community. So there are post-secondary representation in that group, and they work very, very hard to ensure that they are addressing the supports that, again, provide equitable access to students and don't create issues of unfairness or advantage some and disadvantage others. That's easy for me to say and hard for them to do, for sure. I can certainly find ways to get more information from them about how they make their decisions. I think I spent time in the classroom. I was a teacher a long, long time ago. If I were there now, I believe what I would be doing is looking at the supports that are allowable on the assessments and making sure that I adjust to the best extent I can my instruction to mirror those, so that we're not unintentionally putting students in a place where they are received this series of supports, and then on the assessment we have to pull it back. And again, I know that that's easy for me to say and hard for folks like you to do, but I'd be happy to try to facilitate getting more information from them to answer your questions in a deeper way.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Appreciate for your time.
So we've had really good presentations today, which means we've kind of fallen behind on our schedule. We're about out of time. Susan has agreed to roll over her presentation to our next meeting. Clint, would you be comfortable with that as well?
Yeah.
Great.
Can
and I
just,
think.
Can okay. I speak briefly about what I brought? Because everybody
yes,
has it.
Yes, because so. They're at our places.
Yeah,
so go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So I brought, I'm Clint with Voc Rehab. I brought a couple of documents, which you all have copies of. This first one that I just want to touch on briefly is called the 10 Best Practices in Employment Support for People with Disabilities. This is put out by the European Association of Service Providers for Persons with Disabilities. This was they judged the 10 best practices programs in the world for working with people with disabilities, and on page 15 you'll notice that Oregon Youth Transition Program was one of the 10 best practices in the world. So it's got a good reputation. The other document is the biennium report from July 1st, 2011 to June 30th, 2013 on the Youth Transition Program in Oregon. And you know, if you have time over the next few weeks before our next meeting to look through this, because we have really great outcomes. Unfortunately, we're not in all the schools because it's a grant-funded program, and a lot of it is depending on the schools, how much money they can come up with to meet the grant requirements. And so some schools opt out, some schools just can't come up with the money. And we can talk more about it next time.
We will talk more about that next time. I do believe someone is here to offer public comment. Are you here for the transition, or are you here for guns and marijuana?
No, I'm just a spectator.
Okay, great.
There are other copies if anybody in the gallery wants another copy.
Well, thank you all very, very much for coming. As I mentioned before, if you go to the legislative website, we have this OLIS system where you can click on it and you can get all of the materials that are here. You can share those links with other people if they're interested in looking at them. If you are driving back home and you think of other questions, ideas, or agenda topics that you think we should add to this, to our upcoming agendas, please let me know. This is a really great group. I really appreciate the expertise and the variety of perspectives around the table, and thanks to everybody that put a lot of time into today's presentations. And with that, we're adjourned.